And while I think manufacturing as a career used to have a stigma of being dirty or dangerous that I think has changed dramatically over those few decades, some of the systemic issues facing women haven't changed.
Welcome to Ambition Theory, Women in Construction. This show asks questions that everybody is thinking about but doesn't want to say out loud. It's about tackling complex topics like, why are there so few women in senior leadership positions? What is it going to take to change this? Each episode is a combination of motivation and tactical strategies to get ahead. We get out of our comfort zones and we take action. We learn, grow, and create opportunities. I am your host, Andrea Jansen, a certified executive coach with an MBA, and since 2018, I've coached over 1,000 construction professionals to level up their leadership. Let's get started. Getting more women into leadership roles is important for every industry, but especially for manufacturing. The sector lags behind others in terms of representation, particularly in the C-suite. What does it take to attract women to the industrial space? What can companies do to retain these women? What guidance do current women leaders have for the next generation to improve their chances for a successful career in manufacturing? On this episode, we are joined by Kristen Graybill, who shares the results of the Manufacturers Alliance research report called, in her own words, "Breaking the Glass Ceiling is Good for Business." I found this interview fascinating, especially because a lot of the same themes that we're seeing in construction are showing up in manufacturing as well. The construction industry is changing, but there's still work to be done. Our 2023 Building Better Women in Construction report, developed in partnership with the National Center for Construction Education and Research, is your roadmap to bridging the gap. This report highlights what women in construction really want: supportive work environments, career advancement, and access to leadership roles. Did you know that 88% of women in construction aspire to be leaders? Despite this fact, we still see very few women in leadership positions. So what is holding them back? While there are many barriers women face on their path to leadership, Building Better uncovers one key finding that could hold the key to driving change. Women receive sponsorship only half as often as they receive mentorship. While mentorship is helpful, it doesn't actually work to advance women into leadership. Download the 2023 Building Better Report to learn what does. Visit buildingbetterreport.com now to gain valuable insights and discover how you can contribute to creating an industry where everyone can thrive. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to Ambition Theory, Women in Construction. I am so honored that you are here today. Can you introduce yourself and share what you do?
Hi, Andrea. Thank you so much for having me on Ambition Theory. I lead Manufacturing Alliance's commercial strategy, meaning I lead their sales, marketing, and other public-facing activities for the organization. Manufacturers Alliance is a 90-year-old nonprofit whose mission is to power manufacturing leaders. And we also have a 501c3 foundation arm whose research on women's leadership we're going to talk about today.
Okay, I love it. And can you talk about what excites you about the manufacturing industry?
Oh, sure. So my background's in tech and government. I came to manufacturing about 7 years ago. And I think my favorite part about it is learning about the people and companies who make the things who run our world. So from the pipes under my house today, to the elevator in the building, to the desk that my laptop is sitting on, manufacturers make all of these things happen. It's always evolving, it's growing, it's global. So it's an ideal industry for people who like to learn every day.
Hey, I love it. It sounds like such an exciting place to be. And so what we're talking about today is the Manufacturers Alliance Foundation recently published a research report called, in her own words, "Breaking the Glass Ceiling is Good for Business." And one of the stories in this report, which I thought was really powerful, was about Rosie the Riveter, who has become this like iconic image personality of women's empowerment. And It really started as a movement to get women into manufacturing and was very successful at getting women into this field, but not actually sustainable. So I want to talk about this because we see that picture all the time, but we don't necessarily talk about the story behind it, like the positive and also the not so positive. So can you talk about that right now?
Absolutely. And you're 100% right, Andrea. Rosie is an icon, right? I mean, how many of us as little girls dressed up as Rosie the Riveter for Halloween? But I'm a data-driven person, and I think the data is what tells the story here. So most of us know Rosie as the embodiment of the housewife whose husband went to war and who took up arms metaphorically and worked in the factory to keep the factories running during that time. But the data tells us a little different story. So in 1943, that was the year Norman Rockwell published the original illustration of Rosie the Riveter. The U.S. had over 7 million working women, or about 36% of eligible working age women. And the country did see a substantial uptick during the war. So it was only 5 million working women at the beginning of the war in 1939. But jumping back to 1943, of those working women, only 8% were women who had a husband in the armed forces. So most of the women were already working. And they joined manufacturing because it was higher wages, different work, and things that weren't available to them, because back in that time, there were really limited options for women in the workforce. And so the lack of labor due to the war allowed women to take these roles that they had never taken before. But when the war ended, we have surveys from the 1940s that tell us many of the women wanted to keep their jobs. But, you know, we were shifting from this ramp up of wartime production to normal operations. We had to cut. And most of those jobs were cut were women, and the jobs that were available were given to men. And then the government, to reinvigorate the economy after the war, put in some policies at that time that made women only available for the less desirable, lower paid positions in manufacturing. And so due to that, most of the jobs went to men, and the male labor force participation rate in 1948 hit 86%, which is a record we haven't gotten close to since.
Okay, that is really interesting. We don't really go behind the scenes behind that picture, really. We just look at that picture of Rosie the Riveter, and that's where things end. And one thing I find is really interesting in your report, there's a headline that says we're marching in place. So we talk about like making this progress, but then like reversing the progress, making the progress, reversing the progress, like investing all this money and kind of advancing women. But then talk about like what is causing this lack of progress and why are we still marching in place?
It's complicated. That's probably the best answer I can give you. But manufacturing for women, the women's representation in manufacturing has remained the same since the 1970s. And while I think manufacturing as a career used to have a stigma of being dirty or dangerous that I think has changed dramatically over those few decades, some of the systemic issues facing women haven't changed. So one of the things we asked in our research was we asked manufacturing leaders if they felt significant progress had been made providing equal opportunities in pay in manufacturing in the past 5 years. 38% of women said yes. 82% of men said yes. So that view is quite divided. And because there's fewer women in the sector overall, there's also fewer women in mid-management and C-level management. And while they're absolutely wonderful male sponsors to female executives, women also tend to bring women up the ladder. So fewer women mean fewer opportunities to bring women with you and sponsor women. And I think it's also easier to see your career path if you've seen someone who looks like you do it before. And then on the personal side, you know, women, regardless of what sector you work in, we're still the default caregivers. So if a child is home from school, if a parent needs to go to a doctor's appointment, more often than not, that falls to a woman, right? And so the physical nature of manufacturing, like construction, means that some of that flexibility is really limited. You can't run the line from the house. And so we have been seeing this shifting post-COVID in corporate offices and a little bit on the shop floor, but it's not enough to erase the gap of the women who exited the workforce during the pandemic. And then there's issues like unconscious bias, sexual harassment, intimidation, the need for childcare support. There's a lot of things that I think face women in all sectors that we could kind of go on about. But in terms of manufacturing, I think those are the big three.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. And I do not want to keep this episode doom and gloom. So it's great to get those out there, like expose those elephants, be aware that, you know, this is kind of the situation that we're dealing with today. But there's also a lot of positives in your report, like what value women bring to the sector. Can you talk about some of that?
Oh, absolutely. So I think that we heard from women across all different areas of manufacturing, from people in finance, from people in engineering, operations, human resources. So we really dove into a lot of different functions and a lot of different executive levels. I think there's an incredibly positive message here that we heard across so many different stories. A lot of those women hadn't been in manufacturing. Once they got in manufacturing, they haven't left because they love it so much, because it's such an interesting industry to work in. You know, we did hear incredible positive stories about sponsors bringing people up, trying new jobs. I think it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. So we've heard stories about women who have, you know, taken all these different roles to grow their career. You know, we had someone who leads tech and also for a while led HR and for a while led like these very disparate departments. The double-edged sword, I feel like, is that sometimes we ask women to keep adding hats and keep adding opportunities that might be more lateral moves that then jumps up the ladder. So, you know, I think each story is different, each person is different, but for the most part, most of the women we talk to really, really love their careers and can't imagine working anywhere else.
Yeah, I love it. So, but I want to go back to this piece about the lateral moves and the skill set, because we did an episode a couple months ago with Dr. Paul Hickey, and he actually studied this in architecture, engineering, and construction and used LinkedIn data. So it was quantitative data. And what they found was that women, in order to like advance to leadership, women needed to have more certifications, more degrees, more moves in the corporate ladder, and a bigger network in order to get to the same spot level of leadership as a man would. So it sounds like the same thing is happening in manufacturing, where women are encouraged to kind of like have all the skill set, understand everything before they're given that opportunity for that formal leadership position.
Yeah, I think so. And I think some of it goes back to the concept of sponsorship that you talk about in your podcast quite a bit. I think a lot of times leadership will see a man who they have a lot of faith in and give him an opportunity. Whereas the stories we heard from these amazing, prestigious, esteemed women, a lot of the times were they got the opportunity, but they had to prove that they already had the skills to do the job, which they're being asked to do already, to walk in the door. So I think it's a concept of, you know, expectations and hypotheticals versus skills. And I think there are some ways to deal with that in hiring and being very intentional about how companies promote and how they grow, both internally and externally. But yes, I think that data rings true from the stories that I heard.
Yeah. And I love that you brought this up, because I think, honestly, I think it happens unconsciously. Like, I don't think people are consciously like making sure, okay, this person's a woman, I need to make sure like she checks every single box before like we put her in that kind of stretch position, which it isn't actually a stretch position if she's already checked all the boxes. It's really more of a lateral move in that case. But it's really this like unconscious bias of like wanting the woman to be successful, not wanting them to fail, and just like understanding that those nuances exist, I really believe is the way forward, is just calling out those elephants and educating people that this is happening. And you know what? Once you know it's there, you can do something about it. But if you're not aware, it's really hard to take action.
I agree. I think so much of it is unseen. I think most of the men, at least that I've spoke to in manufacturing, are incredible allies. They want a better workplace for everybody as well. And so just being able to see some of those things that we might not see ourselves doing or see our systems or our organizations doing just helps us be better for everyone.
Yes, I love it. And I love that you said that too. It's that like people are going to roll their eyes when I say this, but it's like when the tide rises, all boats rise. Like, it's not about women taking away jobs from men or women are better than men. It's not about any of that. It's really about how do we actually make this industry better for everybody, make it better for companies, more profitable, a better environment, all of those things. So it's not one versus the other.
Absolutely. There's enough sunshine for all of us. So,
well, I love that one. There's enough sunshine for all of us. So I wanted to actually talk about like the nitty gritty. So in your report, what are some of the actions that I want to first start with individuals, and then I want to talk about from a company level.
Sure. So I think as individuals, we hit some of this already. It's awareness, right? Being awareness of some of the things that may be going around you that you don't see, and some of that unconscious bias that's happening. I think for both men and women in manufacturing, it's being intentional about sponsorship. And, you know, sometimes I think particularly with recruiting, you might not see a more diverse set of candidates, but I promise the recruiters out there, there are very well qualified, diverse sets of candidates. We just might have to go look for them somewhere where we haven't looked in the past. And so I think there's some intentionality from the HR and recruiting side too, and most importantly from the company to say that it's important to them to tell their folks to do that. From the company side, the report, we highlighted 9 specific actions companies can take, which kind of intersect with some of these personal actions that you can take. The first is benchmarking your company on flexibility, family, and medical leave. And what we were talking about, being intentional about your recruiting and interviewing, expanding job rotation programs, updating mentorship programs and assigning sponsors, so being very intentional about sponsorship, audit and building your female bench strength, being transparent about your career journeys, job descriptions, and salary bands, having zero tolerance for harassment or intimidation, considering incentives and data transparency, and getting leadership on board. And honestly, for me, I think that last 9th one is probably the most important. If you can get folks at the top on board to have intentional, focused efforts, the rest of these become possible because it doesn't become lip service. It becomes a very serious effort for the company. And as you mentioned earlier, Andrea, there are studies who have found that companies that have more diverse workers and more diverse thought have better financial outcomes. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Hey, I want to go back to this last one, the starting at the top, because what we've noticed is a lot of these, like the women's empowerment movement, is like women have started it, which is great, fantastic, absolutely amazing. But the start at the top and like really shifting from like women being the drivers of this change to the organization being the driver of the change. So have you found that like organizations are like, yes, I'm taking number 9 seriously. We're going to do this. I'm so curious about that. When I started Ambition Theory over 5 years ago, I knew that if we genuinely wanted to make the construction industry inclusive for women, that change needed to start at the top. But 5 years ago, nobody was ready to hear this message. Something has shifted recently, though, and it's really exciting. Organizations are reaching out because they want us to do a presentation for their leadership teams, and in some cases, the entire company. They see that up until now, the burden of change has rested entirely on the shoulders of women. If this message speaks to your association or company, we want to hear from you. Visit ambitiontheory.com/book-a-call to learn how you can book a presentation for your organization.
Yeah, we have, which is great. So one of our member companies who's in electrical manufacturing, they are very focused on their diversity, equity, and inclusion, their DEI efforts. And they have been intentionally very focused on this for the past 2 years. And even through the pandemic, through the economic downturn, they have had this incredible amount of talent that has come to them, stayed with them, and it's showing in their financial performance. So they actually, and their CEO, who happens to be a man, comes out and talks about how important those hiring efforts and that company culture and those core values are to the success of their company. So it's not just the right thing to do for people, which is the first thing, but it's also the right thing to do financially for their shareholders. So I think that as companies continue to explore ways that really make this impactful and meaningful beyond some of that initial conversation and some of those employee resource groups and those things that are really critical and important, but how do we take it up a level? I think we're going to continue to see companies grow and find the financial value that makes it a really strong argument as to why we should care about making things better for everybody.
Okay, that's so great. And I'm really curious, do you know how soon they started to see that return on investment?
I believe they started the program about 4 years ago.
Okay. And so it was
and I'm not sure exactly. I'm sure it's also a multi-factored, you know, all those pieces that go into the deep financials, but I do know it's something that they speak about pretty publicly that is very important to them.
Yeah. So I think the learning for that is the takeaway. It's not a one-off. Like it's not a one-off talk. It's not a one-off like day. It's not a one-off policy. It's really this like commitment that's going to be multi-years. And then when you're able to get to that, after those 4 years, you like can clearly see that return on investment, but maybe it's not an instant like return.
I think that's accurate. Absolutely. And being able to commit to yourself and then learn along the way, as we do with any new initiatives or big projects that companies take on board, you know, how do we pivot? How do we continuously improve? How do we continue to make it better?
Yeah, I actually love that because I feel like no one's going to get it right out of the gate. And the plan that they probably had 4 years ago probably is different than what they're doing today, but they wouldn't be there today if they didn't get started. Because I feel like starting is the hardest part.
Absolutely. I think sometimes it becomes difficult figuring out the message that you give your current employees, the message you're giving your recruiters, the message you're giving the public, and your hopeful employees, and kind of how you bring the truth to that in your day-to-day operations and live that truth. And then what does that mean for the company's success overall and being able to measure? And I think creating some of those measurable KPIs is really important to companies to be able to figure out how the success of these types of programs.
Yeah, definitely having those KPIs. So there's a checkpoint to be like, okay, why are we doing this? And like, is it working? And what do we need to pivot on? Or what do we need to do more of? And having those check-in points over the years, over the months, I think is probably what made this company that we're talking about successful. I have a couple of questions about some of those 9 actions that you have in the report. So you talked about like these 9 stubborn obstacles. And 2 that really stood out for me that I want to unpack a little bit more were bad recruiting and unstructured interviewing. So first, I want to understand, like, what does bad recruiting even mean?
You know, it's subjective, but we heard it consistently throughout our interviewees. So I would consider bad recruiting doing the same thing and expecting different results. So what do I mean by that? So a lot of bad recruiting, I think, is about belonging. If you go to a job fair for engineering and all the companies only have men represented, that might not feel so welcoming as a woman. And I think representation matters, and not just for women, for all people of all different backgrounds, right? And so I think for recruiters and bad recruiting, some of our interviewees told us there are just different things you can do to ensure that you're getting different voices and different thoughts in the room. And some of those are exploring different types of job fairs, working with other associations who have programs like job fairs, where you're going in to meet with different types of people than maybe you did before, exploring relationships with other universities or colleges that perhaps you haven't in the past. And so you're really expanding that pool. And by expanding that pool, you're creating a more diverse audience to A, get to know your company, but B, for you as the recruiters, to get to know more different folks who might be great fits for your job. So I think some of it is just being very intentional about growing that audience for your company.
Okay, that's cool. And then let's talk about the unstructured interviewing, because I thought that part was really insightful. So can you explain what that means and like what's happening today and then kind of what's the way to fix it?
Sure, I will do my best, but yes. So we're all biased, right? I'm biased, you're biased, all of us are biased. And that can play out in a variety of ways in an interviewing process. And we talked about this a little bit earlier in terms of kind of men having that opportunity without the skills and women being forced to prove the skills before they can get the job. And so we heard that a lot and we've seen it play out in the data. And so intentional interviewing is trying to eliminate that problem. And what it does is intentional behavioral interviewing is a set of questions and a ranking system that whoever is on the interviewing team agrees to ahead of time. So probably HR, your hiring manager, your sponsor, your team, anyone who's going to be talking to the person, and they rank everyone the exact same way. And so that takes out some of that good feelings you might have if you meet someone who's an alumni of the same college that you went to, or, you know, part of your same community group, or some of those things that really has no bearing on the job at hand. And so being able to just have a consistent way to look at candidates across everyone helps take some of that out. Do I think it's perfect? Probably not, but I think it's a really good step in the right direction to try to be able to level the playing field to find the best qualified candidate for the job.
Yeah, I like that because it creates that opportunity to explore that feeling, right? You're like, oh, I really like that candidate, right? The last candidate, but like, why did you like them? And then in that, like the ranking questions, it helps you like explore like what was actual the reasons why you liked them. And then you can think about it. Well, I like this person because of that. And then it gives you some data point to compare to the other candidates just to see and really like explore, is it bias or is there actually something really tangible there that makes that person stand out? But like we're human and we're emotional. So we do make decisions based on emotion. And I love that you have this tool that helps like anybody, like just really explore those emotions and like, you know, give some meat to it. I think that's really cool.
No, thank you. Again, I think it's just bringing awareness to the issue, right? And the more that we're all aware and self-aware about it, the more we can do to try to take some of that bias out of our decision making.
Okay, that's cool. And so I want to talk about the manufacturing as an exciting career option. You talked about a little bit about why you like it. But first off, I want to understand a little bit more why women come to the industry in the first place.
You know, a lot of the stories we heard had family who were in manufacturing. So, and honestly, a lot of them were dads, right? So a lot of them had dads who were in manufacturing, or a lot of them just fell into it. So particularly on the corporate side, maybe they were a CPA in a completely different industry, or they were a consultant and they kind of fell into it and fell in love. I think the thing that I heard consistently was whether you work in a corporate office or you're on the operational side with your hands getting metaphorically dirty all day, everyone liked walking the shop floor, seeing the production, being part of the action of developing products and new tools and new systems, and kind of just being part of that process of creating something. And then, you know, in the years that I've been with Manufacturers Alliance, I've had the chance to meet with probably hundreds of manufacturing leaders over the years. And I think the core theme that stands out to me is what I hear is just how interesting they find the work. That it's whether you're crunching numbers in the background or you're hands-on, that interest and that complexity and the thing about making something tangible to our world is just really exciting for folks in that space.
Okay, that's exciting. And then what makes them stay? You said a bunch of people, like, they kind of find their way into it. Is it the same kind of things, like being part of that team, actually seeing the fruits of your labor, like literally come to life right in front of you? Are those the reasons why they stay?
I think so. That's a lot of what we heard. And I think, you know, some folks who maybe didn't want to sit in an office and they're exploring different ways, manufacturing gives you a chance to do some of those corporate roles, but also still get out on the floor, still travel, still have a little more physicality to your job than a lot of other sectors, like, you know, a software or a tech that might not necessarily require that of you. So I think part of that is really fascinating and interesting to people who stay as well.
Okay, that's cool. And one thing, we've learned a lot today. So thank you so much for sharing all this with us, Kristen. So if people are listening, we always end our podcast with a 24-hour action. So that's one nugget that people can take away and start implementing right away. So a micro action that they can take. What is something that people can do now that they're aware of these issues? And these are not limited to manufacturing. These issues really are present in most industries today. So whatever industry you're in, you can probably take this nugget. So what's something people can do?
I think it goes back to that self-awareness. So whether you're a woman, whether you're a man, are any of these things we talked about, any of these challenges or obstacles resonating in your workplace? And if it is there something you can do in your role or your department or talk to your boss? Is there something you can do to help shed some light on this to perhaps take the next step? And I think, you know, by reducing these obstacles for everyone, it's good for men as well, because who doesn't want better parental leave or better benefits for families or better hiring? So by supporting things that support women, we really do support everyone.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for that. And how do people access this research?
Please come to our website. It's manufacturersalliance.org. You can also follow us, Manufacturers Alliance, on LinkedIn, X, or Facebook. And we'd love to have you download the report and dig in a little more.
Okay, awesome. And how do people connect with you? Is LinkedIn the best way?
It is. So if you are looking for me on LinkedIn, it's just linkedin.com/ Kay Graybill.
Awesome. Thank you so much for this interview today, Kristen. It has been a joy.
Thank you, Andrea. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for chatting with me about these important issues.
Hey, before you go, I wanted to take a minute to read a review of our podcast. This review is from Kinia from Canada. Andrea asks incredibly thoughtful, well-researched, and practical questions to provide actionable strategies for her audience. Her dedication and passion shine through in her preparation and delivery. Thank you so much for that generous review. We really love hearing from our listeners. And I'm wondering if I can ask you a favor. Can you take a minute and leave us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts? That really helps us to get the word out so that we can keep making episodes for you for free. Thank you for listening.